Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Johnson, Judge Riley, Judge Reyes, the Honorable Matthew E. Johnson presiding.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. There is no need to rise. Just to be clear, that's fine. Thank you for remaining seated. Today's date is July 8, 2020. This panel of the court today has three cases set for oral argument. This is the second of the three cases. The case is number A19-1944, NH and Lucero versus Anoka Hennepin School District number 11. And we are hearing oral argument by video conferencing using the WebEx technology. I assume counsel is familiar with it. Let me make one suggestion, and that is, depending on the viewing mode you're using, the time clock, which you probably can see now if you're looking at all of the screens, it may slip from your view if you have the speaker on most of the screen and you have small tiles at the bottom. So if while you're giving your argument, if you want to make sure that you're aware of your time remaining, I would recommend keeping your view in the view that shows all participants. I want to apologize and explain the fact that we have limited public access, even limited access for parties and counsel for this oral argument. We have, in order to make sure that the video conferencing technology works properly, we have limited the participation only to those people who are speaking. We've even excluded unnecessary staff, court staff. So I apologize for that. I understand there's probably interest among the parties and all of the lawyers in this case. We're working on expanding that, but takes a little bit of time, of course, as you might imagine. We're just trying to cope with new circumstances and accomplish our essentials. So thank you for understanding that. I believe those are my preliminaries. I'd like to first make sure that I can do a sound check with the other two judges on the panel, Judge Riley and Judge Reyes. Can you see and hear me?
Yes, I can.
I can also.
Okay, very good. And let me just check with Respondents' Counsel too before we go any further. Mr. Davis, can you see and hear all of us so far?
So far, so good, Judge. Thank you. Okay.
And Ms. Bell Munger?
Yes, Your Honor, I can see and hear you all.
Okay, very good. Then Ms. Basis, on behalf of appellant, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jeanette Basis. I represent Anoka Hennepin School District in this matter. I was hoping to begin by reviewing at a very high level the undisputed facts. Plaintiff NH was a transgender male student.
Ms. Basis?
Yes.
I think we're all familiar with the facts and the record, although it is quite voluminous. Actually, if you don't mind, I'd like to jump to a question that I have right off the top, and that is with respect to the Goins case.
Yeah.
And I've reviewed that case several times, and I don't see any reference to the educational provision of the Minnesota Human Rights Act at all there. Does that Goins case discuss the educational provision of the MHRA at all?
It does not, Your Honor, but what it does do...
Okay, so if it doesn't discuss it, it doesn't apply it, it doesn't analyze it, it doesn't look at the educational provision, why would that be controlling if it's not on all fours?
Yes, Your Honor, good question. So the definitional subsection, well, I should say, for all contexts, whether it's in the employment, housing, public accommodations, public services, or education, with respect to each subsection, the MHRA defines discrimination the same as to segregate or to separate.
That's the definition of discrimination.
Right. So okay. The employment section, of course, bans discrimination in the conditions, facilities, or privileges of employment. And as Goins stated, it's hardly open to debate that the use of employee restrooms qualifies as a condition, facility, or privilege of employment, but it still held what it held because what it found is...
Well, but that, and what was the exact holding in Goins?
The holding in Goins was that the MHRA neither, if I can find the quote, neither prohibits or requires...
That wasn't the holding. That wasn't the holding in Goins.
The holding did go directly to the employment section, Your Honor.
Correct. So again, I ask, why is Goins controlling for this case, which is interpreting and applying Section 363A.13 Subdivision 1, which is the educational provision of the MHRA?
I think because it's because of the definition and how it construed discriminate in terms of separation and segregation, and indicated that segregation and segregation based on biological gender is not prohibited by the Act.
But you have the two provisions are different. Bottom line, I'll be right up front. I don't buy the argument that Goins is controlling, because it doesn't interpret Section 363A.13 Subdivision 1 of the MHRA. And I think we need to look at that provision and the plain language there. Now, I certainly accept that you may argue it's persuasive authority, but I don't see how it's binding when it doesn't even reference, discuss, or analyze, much less hold, that 363A.13 Subdivision 1 means you know, it doesn't apply that or interpret that at all.
I hear you. I think what I rest on, Your Honor, is 363A.03 Subdivision 13, the definition of discrimination, which is employed both in the employment section 0.08 and the education section 0.13. Both prohibit discrimination, one with respect to facilities, employment, and one with respect to the full utilization or benefit of any educational institution.
So let's turn to the educational provision of the MHRA. It says, quote, it is an unfair discriminatory practice, which is different than the employment one, which talks about employment practice, to discriminate. And then this is also different in any manner in the full utilization of or benefit from any educational institution or the services rendered thereby to any persons because of, and I'll jump to, sexual orientation. So my question in terms of looking at that provision, which is the one that is in dispute here, do you take the position at all that that is in any way, shape, or form ambiguous, or do you think we just need to look at the plain language?
I think we always have to begin with a plain language, Your Honor, but I think in this instance and in this with respect to 0.13, if you read it literally, it would mean that boys cannot be restricted from going into girls' restrooms. Boys could
not. But that's, I think that's a different issue. You're talking about sex. I want to focus on sexual orientation, which is another provision, another term in here. And I think that's the one that NH bases his claim on, is his sexual orientation and his gender identity.
Correct. The district's position, Your Honor, is that when sexual orientation was added to this subsection in 1993, the legislature, there's nothing in the legislative history, which I think we need to look at here, nothing in the legislative history in any of the amicus briefs or anything cited by the parties that indicates the legislature had in mind access to restrooms and locker rooms.
Well, why do we need to look at the legislative history? Why can't we just look at the plain language, as you'd mentioned? And it says that it, and we're supposed to interpret the MHRA very broadly. In addition to that, it has very, very broad language that is not included, by the way, in the employment provision that the Goins court interpreted. It says it prohibits discriminatory practice in any manner in the full utilization of or benefit of from an educational institution. So that seems to be very, very broad language there, right?
It is, but I think it can also lead to the absurd result, as I started to say, because sex is included in that same sentence, sex or sexual orientation. that would mean if read literally to exclude, as the Supreme Court has said, we can, based on biological gender, again, that boys could access girls' rooms and boys can access girls'
rooms. But we're not talking about, that's not the case before us. Those are not the facts here. The facts we have here are a transgender male student whose sexual orientation and gender identity is male. And that's part of the undisputed facts. And even looking at the facts like most favorable to NH, I think the district has readily conceded to its credit that he is self-identifies as male. He has, socially he has made that change and recognized that, and in fact even accepted him and welcomed him in the school district by administration, by the students, by the swim team. So it's sexual orientation that we're talking about here, not sex. It's sexual orientation of a transgender male. So looking at that plain language, how is it that the actions by the district, by the school district, did not violate this provision? Or maybe a better way of saying it, why is it that NH has not laid out a viable claim to overcome a Rule 12 motion to dismiss?
Again, Your Honor, the district's position is that it relied on what it viewed as controlling precedent in Gowen that said that to segregate or separate based on biological gender isn't violative of the Minnesota Human Rights Act. And I recognize what Your Honor is saying, that it's a different position.
Sorry to interrupt. If I'd like to follow up on that a minute about your interpretation of Goins. So at the time of the Goins opinion, the definition of discriminate was, I think, the same as it is today. It includes to separate or to segregate, or words to that effect. I don't believe the Supreme Court's opinion in Goins made any reference to that definition, to those words. Correct me if I'm wrong. But I'm wondering if you interpret that to mean that in the Goins case, there was in fact no separation and no segregation, or whether the reasoning acknowledges separation and segregation, but reasons that it's nonetheless lawful. Do you have a view on that?
I do think that Goins recognized exactly what the court was doing. It said in footnote 4 that Goins, the use of restroom facilities, it's hardly open to debate that the use of employee restrooms qualifies as a condition, facility, or privilege of employment. The court basically went on to say that it would have, I'm looking for the language, that essentially that to conclude that the legislature intended for biological males and biological females to share restrooms and locker rooms, that was not the legislature's intent, and that's something that the legislature should speak to.
And so I'm still unclear whether that means that there was separation and segregation, or there was, but it was excused under the law, or that it was not, the facts simply did not trigger that definition, did not satisfy it.
I don't know how it could be construed to not trigger it based on the concessions that the court made, the Minnesota Supreme Court made, in saying that Goins was required to use a single-use restroom on a different floor or in a different building.
Okay. Thank you. I have a very general question about the overall the review that we're doing here. We're here on certified questions following the denial of a motion to dismiss. I mean, ordinarily, certified questions are pure questions of law. Ordinarily, a Rule 12 motion is based upon the facts that are alleged in the complaint. I'm just a little bit confused about how we should be analyzing this and what the result of our analysis should be. I mean, are we, in your view, essentially reviewing the propriety of the district court's ruling on the Rule 12 motion, or are we doing something different? And if so, could you characterize it, please?
Yes. The legal questions, I should say, that are posed by the two certified questions, the answers to those will either result in an affirmance or a reversal of the district court's rulings on the MHRA and the equal protection claims.
And so you are asking us to not just simply consider an abstract, pure question of law, but to consider the questions of law in the context of NH's complaint.
Absolutely. This is not an advisory opinion at all. This is based on the facts alleged in the complaint, which really all of the material facts here are undisputed.
Maybe you'd like to turn to the equal protection issue in your time remaining. And I will say that I will not be so fastidious with the allotments of time. I think that I'm sure counsel have a lot to say. Judges have a lot of questions. And so I want to make sure that people have a chance to at least touch on, counsel have a chance to touch on the arguments they wish to touch on. Judges have a chance to get their most important questions answered. So even though that clock is counting down, getting close to zero, I'm willing to go beyond that for each attorney. You may proceed.
Ms. Basis, this is Judge Riley. When you turn to the equal protection question, I am curious about what you think similarly situated means in this case. When I was reviewing the many cases that talk about similarly situated, they seem to kind of say, oh yeah, they are, and skip right over that question, really. And so in this case, who do you think NH is similarly situated to? And do you think that's important for us to look at?
Well, obviously, yeah, the question is whether he's similarly situated with regard to the government action being challenged. He does not state in his complaint who he believes he's similarly situated to, if I'm not mistaken. But we believe he doesn't meet that threshold requirement. And that's because of State versus Turner. Relying on U.S. Supreme Court precedent, State versus Turner held in the equal protection analysis that individuals are not similarly situated when a distinction is based on differences between unclothed male and unclothed female body parts. And here, NH isn't similarly situated to his cisgender male peers for the purposes of the locker room use because of the real physical difference between his body, unclothed body, and that of his peers.
But counsel, the Turner opinion, didn't that deal with, that's a 1986 case, didn't that deal with and interpret the word sex?
No.
Gender?
No, it
didn't. In terms of the analysis of the biological difference between males and females.
What Turner was looking at, a Minneapolis Park Board ordinance that basically said that required that genitalia be covered and et cetera. And it said that female breasts had to be covered with opaque clothing. So that's what it was looking at. It wasn't looking at the definition of gender. What they said is females aren't situated like men because their breasts, their physiologies are different than men.
Right, but it's a sex-based. What the court there looked at, they were looking at cisgender males and cisgender females, correct?
That's correct. Well, they didn't specify. They were talking about body parts, but
right. I mean, they didn't use that terminology back in 1986. I understand.
But I imagine the same analysis would apply to a transgender boy if that boy still had breasts, that the police, and that law is still on the books today. So if I or say NH were at Lake Bede Makaska sunbathing topless, we would probably both get ticketed for that because it speaks to an uncovered breast.
But isn't that the wrong lens that we're analyzing it through? Because what we have here, we don't have a cisgender male and a cisgender female. What we have here is a transgender male who has socially transitioned, completely socially transitioned, and identifies as male. His gender identity is male, and he wants to be able to use the same facilities as other people who identify as male. So why is it that through the sexual orientation lens and gender identity lens of which his claim is based, why is he not similarly situated to other male students?
According to the Minnesota Supreme Court, body parts matter, whether they're female body parts or male body parts. So,
but that's looking at it through the lens of sex. But counsel, sorry to interrupt, but that's looking at it through the lens of sex. We're not looking at it through the lens of sex in terms of your designated sex at birth. What we are looking at is how a person identifies and self-identifies. In other words, we're looking at sexual orientation and the, well, let me ask you this. What's the definition of sexual orientation?
In the statute, it is, and again, that's not, again, this is off Turner, of course, having or being perceived as having a self-image or identity not traditionally associated with one's biological maleness or femaleness.
Okay, so he certainly fits that definition. NH certainly fits that definition. And if you look at that, how is he not similarly situated to other males who also identify, cisgender males who identify as male?
Again, our Supreme Court told us in Goins and it told us in Turner that different physiologies, biological maleness and femaleness matter. It's even in the definition of sexual order.
Right, but you're looking at it as either black or white, as a simple dichotomy. And what we have with respect to sexual orientation is a spectrum. How would you, what if somebody has sexual organs of both sexes? How would you apply that then?
How would the school district apply it? I don't know. I would be purely speculating because it's not something that they've had to address as far as I know.
Up to this point.
Correct.
I believe you said a few minutes ago, Ms. Basis, that NH is not anatomically similar to the cisgender boys who use the boys' locker room. Am I correct in that?
Yes.
Is that what you said? But I'm wondering how we know that. I do not see any affirmative allegation in the complaint which says either he has had certain treatments or procedures or has not had certain treatments and procedures. The complaint seems to be silent on that. And so I'm not sure how we should analyze that.
I mean, it does say he was assigned the sex female at birth, and it simply says that he had socially transitioned by the time of his freshman year. I think it's undisputed. Obviously, you can speak with plaintiff's counsel about that, but that's my understanding that that's an undisputed fact in this case.
But we don't have anything to indicate that.
I'm sorry, Judge.
Yeah, but we don't have anything to indicate that he has done anything more, hormonal treatment, surgery, any physical changes. There isn't anything in the record.
Well, I think Mr. Davis can probably answer that better than me, but no. I mean, simply the statement that he was assigned a female sex at birth and that he'd socially transitioned, I think that's the closest we get. And again, I'm sure Mr. Davis will help us out here.
And then again,
Can I ask a question?
Yeah. Yeah. So Mike, if I could make one comment regarding the last question, and that is, if we are limited to the allegations in the complaint, I'm not sure if Mr. Davis can add anything more than just simply what the complaint says and how it should be construed. But you're right. That's a good question for him. Judge Riley, please proceed.
In Goins, the court said if the legislature, I'm on page 723, said that if the legislature wanted to clarify further what they meant, then we could look for more guidance from the legislature. And it seems that things have happened since Goins came out and since this law was passed back in many years ago. And I'm thinking about the School Safety Technical Assistance Council that was established by the legislature and some other things. How do you think that informs our analysis?
I don't think, you know, I'm just thinking about our reply brief and other states' laws that have passed in recent years that are extremely on point and very specifically direct school districts and others as to what they're supposed to do. Meaning transgender people shall be permitted access to restrooms and locker rooms consistent with their gender identity. I don't think, for instance, what you mentioned, the toolkit, for instance, is just guidance by the DOE. And interestingly, it could have gone a lot farther than it did. And frankly, it may be purposefully ambiguous because what it does say is that transgender students should be permitted access to use the restroom of their choice. So it says transgender students should be afforded the opportunities to use the restroom of their choice. They don't say that with respect to locker rooms. They could very easily have said that and it either in that same section or a second section. But what it says instead is POTUS should consider how they can utilize privacy curtains, restrooms, and separate changing schedules to provide privacy for all students. So why definitely our society has changed immensely for instance, since I was in high school, let alone college, let alone law school. But even the DOE didn't go that far in this guidance that it issued in 2017, because I think it recognized that maybe society's not quite there yet. And that may be unfortunate. Setting my personal feelings aside, though, I don't think that there's been any legislation or guidance that controls here. Even when the opportunity was presented to the DOE, it still didn't do it. It didn't go that far.
Thank you, Ms. Basis. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal after respondents' counsel have argued. My understanding is that the respondents' two counsel are splitting their time 12 and 3 with Mr. Davis going first. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, you may proceed.
Thank you. Good afternoon. May it please the court. The district's argument today commits three fundamental legal errors. First, it ignores the plain, unambiguous, and broad language of 363A.13. Second, it misapplies the rule of stare decisis, stretching the Goins decision well beyond its facts and its narrow holding in the employment context. And third, it exaggerates any possible state interest in segregating trans kids from their cisgender peers. And the broad coalition of support before you today in the form of the intervener, Attorney General and the Minnesota Department of Human Rights, as well as the Department of Education and the MSBA, belie any possible state interest in that segregation. The language of 363A.13 is unambiguous, and the district concedes this. Because the act is unambiguous, there is no need for the court to look to legislative history at all.
And what language specifically are you referring to?
I'm referring to the language of 363A.13, which states that it is an unfair discriminatory practice to discriminate in any manner in the full utilization of or benefit from any educational institution on the basis of sexual orientation. So what we have here, assuming all the facts are true in the complaint, in the posture before this court, the district forced NH to use a separate enhanced privacy area for changing because of his transgender status. So it segregated and separated him, that is, discriminated against him, because of his sexual orientation, which is defined in the MHRA to include his transgender status. That's discrimination under the Act, plain and simple. Now, the district offers up two arguments to support its position that segregating NH because of his transgender status is still not discrimination. And I'll jump to the Goins discussion first. The district argues that the Minnesota Supreme Court decision in Goins allows it to discriminate against NH. As Your Honor correctly pointed out, Goins addressed a separate employment provision of the Act under 363A.08. That provision is simply not at issue here. Goins did not hold that 363A.13, the education provision, allows a school district to segregate a transgender student from a bathroom or locker room that corresponds with his gender identity. In effect, what the district is doing is making a statutory construction argument in peri materia. It's saying, let's look at this other statute to inform how we interpret 363A.13. But the court does not go to in peri materia if the language before it is plain and unambiguous. It only does that if there's a question about the plain language of the statute. And the district has conceded that there is not.
So, Mr. Davis, at the time of Goins, the MHRA defined discriminate in the same way, right? It includes to separate or to segregate.
Correct.
So given we have the same statute to that extent, and the Goins Supreme Court did not seem to invoke that language, shouldn't this court take some cues from that?
Respectfully, I would submit that the court should not. Again, going back to the statutory construction point, Goins interpreted a different statute. We are not dealing, and there are, as Ms. Bezos conceded, there are significant differences in the language of those two provisions. But moreover, Goins simply didn't consider key distinctions that exist between the educational context and the employment context. For example, the very real mental health crisis that exists among our transgender youth today as a result of just this kind of discrimination. And our briefing points it out, but there's just a heartbreaking statistic, according to the Minnesota Department of Education, which is that in 2016, approximately half of all transgender children reported having attempted suicide within the prior 2 years.
I was going to ask you on that issue, Mr. Davis. Your complaint makes a lot of statements about psychological harm to children in general, not just to NH. And I'm wondering if those statements in your complaint, which I guess I'll regard as fact or regard them as true unless persuaded otherwise under Rule 12, but does your claim depend upon those facts? In other words, must you prove those facts at trial in order for your client to prevail?
We certainly intend to prove those facts if this case moves forward in discovery. Ultimately, whether the case rises or falls on those facts, I don't think it does. And I will point out to the court that there really is not a dispute between the parties as to what the facts are here. I mean, the facts are simple. And the key facts for the court are the facts that the district forced NH to use a separate changing area because he is transgender. That is really a key fact. We do intend to prove that that caused harm to NH, and more broadly, that is the type of harm that the MHRA was intended to prevent. So it does go to the question of what is the purpose of the MHRA, which is broadly a remedial purpose to prohibit discrimination, in particular with respect to students. And given that educational institutions are one of the cornerstones of our democracy, and the MHRA recognized the importance of prohibiting discrimination specifically in that context. But
I'd like to ask the same question. I'm sorry, did Judge Riley? I wasn't sure if another judge was speaking up. I have the same question with respect to your equal protection claim. The question whether psychological harm is either relevant or necessary. It seems to me that depending upon the level of scrutiny, the governmental interest may or may not be stronger if there is established the potential or actual psychological harm. I'm wondering if you... If that's what your argument is. Don't mean to make your argument for you, but I'm wondering if that's what your position is today.
Our position would be that that is certainly something that the court should consider in determining what the appropriate interest is in whatever ultimately the question for the district and for a court reviewing this case would be, what is the interest put forward by the district in its decision, its application of the guidelines to segregate NH. We submit that whether the court is applying strict scrutiny or intermediate scrutiny, and by the way, we think strict scrutiny is the appropriate standard here, but under either of those standards, the district simply has not put forth either a compelling state interest or an important state interest to justify its actions. And I do think that the psychological harm, emotional harm, and physical harm should be taken into account as well as a countervailing consideration to what the state says its interests are. I want to jump back to going.
Judge Riley. How do you respond to Ms. Bass's reliance on Turner and other high court decisions that male and female bodies are different and therefore they don't come under the Equal Protection Clause?
My response to that is I would point the court to two decisions, In Re Welfare of RDL, which is Minnesota Supreme Court 2014, and the Durand case, Minnesota Supreme Court 2015. Both of those cases begin to question whether the court should even apply a similarly situated test in the first place. And in particular, if the court can resolve the case by determining and applying the appropriate level of scrutiny, whether it's strict or intermediate, the similarly situated analysis really doesn't come into play. And the Minnesota Supreme Court.
But in the RDL case, counsel, in the RDL case, didn't they question whether or not the similarly situated threshold question should be asked, but didn't they ultimately still apply it?
Your Honor, yes, they did.
And so I'm kind of struggling here because it seems that your argument in your brief seems to be that we don't even need to apply the similarly situated test, but it seems that the Minnesota Supreme Court, even though it has questioned it, it still has ultimately applied it, and we need to follow Minnesota Supreme Court precedent. So let's assume for the sake of argument that the similarly situated test applies. Can you clarify why you think that NH meets the similarly situated threshold question?
Yes, Your Honor, I can. And it really relates to gender identity and an appropriate conception of what that means. NH is like any other high school boy who wants to participate in sports and use the boys' locker room. If you looked at NH, you would see a boy with a butch cut haircut who wants to do what any other teenage boy wants to do. He wants to play video games. He wants to skateboard. He wants to hang out with his friends. The only difference is that he has a gender identity that is male that does not correspond with the sex he was assigned at birth. And so he is similarly situated to every other high school boy, except for the fact that he's transgender. And so the district is treating the very protected trait in question here, as highlighted in the MHRA, even though we're in the equal protection analysis, which is NH's transgender status, and it's zeroing in on that trait as the basis for its discrimination. So if if that is the out for the district to say, well, he's not similarly situated because his protected characteristic makes him different, that would eviscerate the court's equal protection review. I mean, think about other protected characteristics where the plaintiff is similarly situated in all respects except for national origin, religious belief, race, sexual orientation. It would gut the equal protection review entirely. I see that my time has expired, and I want to make sure that Ms. Bell Munger has time. I'm happy to continue, and I do have some additional points I would really like to make.
Actually, Judge Johnson, if I might ask a question or two more.
Yeah, please feel free. I have one or two more as well. Judge Riley may. Judge Bell, Ms. Bell Munger will not be prejudiced in her time.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to ask you about the level of, assuming he did meet the similarly situated threshold, let's assume that just for the sake of argument right now. You argue for strict scrutiny, but are you aware of any case, transgender case, whether state or federal, and I'm thinking particularly federal with respect to Title IX, that has applied or said that strict scrutiny should apply? It seems like all the cases, the ones that do say that there is an equal protection claim, apply intermediate scrutiny. And the United States Supreme Court, I think, has been pretty loath to add to the list of the four that have already been identified. And they certainly have not spoken, even recently, with the case that they just announced in June, and just a few weeks ago. There's no mention of strict scrutiny with respect to sexual orientation.
Thank you for that question, Your Honor. We are aware of two cases. One is Crowder versus Diaz. We've cited in our briefing. It's an Eastern District of California case. That case did hold that transgender is a suspect class. And then the other decision, which is briefed extensively, is the Outfront Minnesota versus DHS case.
That's a district court.
Correct.
Minnesota case. It's not a published case. It's not even a case that has come up to the Court of Appeals, much less Supreme Court. So it's not even a binding case.
The other one is persuasive,
and that's,
I would say is that based on the allegations in the complaint, it is very clear transgender individuals have been subject to a long and alarming history of discrimination. They are a tiny portion of the population. They are politically powerless. And they fall squarely within the factors for a suspect class under Minnesota Supreme Court case law. The Bostock decision that you referenced, it's true that that case is a Title VII case, but I did want to touch on that case because, importantly, and we brought it to the court's attention, Bostock rejects the very argument that the district has advanced here. It's and essentially what Bostock does is it says, the argument that Congress could not possibly intended the anti-discrimination provision in Title VII to include transgender individuals does not mean that the language of the statute does not apply. If that were the holding, it would always tilt the law in favor of the powerful and would always preserve the status quo. Justice Gorsuch said that judges are not free to overlook plain statutory commands on the strength of nothing more than supposition about intent or guesswork about expectations. So in Goins, we have a decision where the Supreme Court says, let's essentially put aside the language of the MHRA. We can't imagine the legislature intended transgender employees to use the bathroom that corresponds to their gender identity. That would upset cultural norms, and it would significantly disrupt the status quo that we are all comfortable with. And what Bostock does is it says, that is not the court's job. The court's job is not to preserve cultural preferences. The court's job is to apply the plain language of the statute.
And Mr. Davis, so I'm sorry to interrupt you. I'm sorry to apologize to Judge Reyes, too, for interrupting your answer, but we're running short in time. But I but I'd like to ask a question about the difference between bathrooms and locker rooms. It seems that most of the federal cases analyzing equal protection claims arise from issues about bathrooms. And some of those courts say that, you know, every bathroom has a private toilet stall. It seems that locker rooms, depending upon their structure, how they're built, present different issues where potentially a person is naked, completely unclothed in the course of showering and changing. Shouldn't we or mustn't we focus on the case law concerning locker rooms as more relevant than the case law about bathrooms?
Well, Your Honor, I would point the court to a recent Ninth Circuit decision, and it was cited in our brief. It's Parents for Privacy versus Barr. And in this case, there was a policy that essentially said trans students shall have equal access to bathrooms, locker rooms, and other facilities that correspond with their gender identity. And the court, a group called Parents for Privacy, made an argument that locker rooms are different, and we have a privacy interest in our unclothed bodies, students do, and therefore in this policy violates that right to privacy. The Ninth Circuit evaluated that claim and ultimately rejected it. It said there is that right to privacy does not exist in the 14th Amendment. To the extent there are cases that are cited by the district for that proposition, they're Fourth Amendment cases. They deal with the power of the state to conduct a search and seizure. And those cases involve forced strip searches, non-consensual surveillance in locker rooms, and things of that nature. It's a far cry from the facts here. And the reality is, if you're a teenager, okay.
Mr. Davis, we're going to be running long, okay. And we have another case after this one with lawyers waiting. Judge Riley, do you have any more questions for Mr. Davis? Judge Reyes.
Thank you,
Mr. Davis. Ms. Bell Munger.
It pleases the court and counsel. My name is Rachel Bell Munger, and I represent the commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. The state of Minnesota, by Commissioner Lucero, intervened in this case to support NH and to seek redress against Anoka Hennepin School District. The commissioner is simply asking the court today to recognize that the forced segregation of a student because of his gender identity violates the Minnesota Human Rights Act, and the act does not tolerate separate but equal treatment in Minnesota schools. The act's language, as the court has highlighted, is unambiguous in that it prohibits the school district from treating NH differently because his gender identity is not in conformity with the sex assigned to him at birth. The act does not contain an exemption for school locker room use based on gender identity, for accommodating alleged privacy concerns and allowing those to override one's obligations under the act, or furthering discrimination in the name of protecting cultural or social norms. The school district has indicated in briefing that those on NH's side are asking the court to legislate a policy debate, but the opposite is true here. The school district is asking the court to legislate by reading in an exception that constrains the scope of the act that does not exist in the statutory text. The court should decline the invitation and remember the act's directive of protecting the civil rights of students to attend school and learn free from discrimination. I think there's some argument as well about that we should be stuck in 1993 and what the legislature may have intended at that time, but that's not appropriate here when the court's task is to apply the plain language, and we're not engaged in a dispute about what a word in the statute means, but rather the scope of the act's coverage. This is an issue, and I won't repeat Mr. Davis's arguments, but that the Supreme Court really effectively addressed in Bostock, indicating that just because an act may have unanticipated application doesn't mean it's ambiguous. It just demonstrates the breadth and scope of the legislative command. The Human Rights Act scope and the educational institution discrimination provision is broad, and the legislature required a broad reading of the act. And I think there's a recent Minnesota Supreme Court decision, Your Honor, when we're talking about some of our understanding of issues that have evolved over time. It's not cited in the briefing, but it is from early June, the Kenna versus Homeward Bound, Inc. decision. The full site is 944 Northwest 2nd 222, where the court recognized that for a standard under the Human Rights Act to remain useful, it has to evolve to reflect societal attitudes. And that's consistent with the directive in WERIG that the essence of the act is societal change. The school district cannot point to any language that supports its reading of the statute, but instead cites to Goines, which the court is well aware is not a school case, deals with a different provision. And frankly, it would be harmful to extend the holding in Goines to the school setting based on the compelling facts presented in NH's complaint. And I see I'm running out of time. I'm open to the court's questions, but the commissioner would ask that the court answer the certified questions in the affirmative and affirm the district court's decision. But I'm also available to answer the court's questions if there are any.
Judge Reyes, Judge Riley. I have a question. It's, I guess, more of a practical question than a legal question, but I think we all have to acknowledge that this school district and all school districts are in a difficult situation, trying to accomplish multiple goals, which at first blush seem irreconcilable. Perhaps there are ways to reconcile them, and that's perhaps what we're all working on. But Ms. Bell Munger, would you agree that school districts must have more than two bathrooms or two locker rooms in all places for all purposes in order to comply? Or do you believe that a school district can comply with the MHRA and all other legal requirements with only two locker rooms?
And is Your Honor asking whether a school district can have just a boys' locker room and a girls' locker room, or just two? I just want to make sure I'm understanding the question, well, Your Honor.
I think I started by saying, you know, how can a school district satisfy all of its obligations in the situation where some percentage of its students are transgender and they have preferences of using locker rooms, which may be in conflict with the preferences of other students or of the traditional way in which locker rooms and bathrooms are identified and used?
Mm-hmm. Your Honor, I appreciate that they can be difficult decisions, but here the department's view in NH's case is that the school district should have honored NH's preference and how he was socially transitioning and living consistent with his gender identity. He didn't want to be segregated. The school district shouldn't have segregated him because he is transgender. He wanted to use a boys' locker room just like everyone else. And by segregating him, the district violated the law. And I think, Your Honor, in terms of privacy questions or other people's objections, that doesn't get around a school district compliance with the Human Rights Act. You know, that doesn't trump their compliance with the act. There can be discomfort in eradicating discrimination on any number of grounds, including sexual orientation and gender identity. But that is the purpose of the act. And the legislature did not constrain the act's coverage in the way advocated by the school district.
One more question. It seems to me that this case is different from Goines and different from a lot of the precedents cited. In most of the cases cited, the plaintiff wishes to use the bathroom or locker room that matches his or her gender identity, and the employer or school district usually requires the person to use the bathroom of the other gender. Here, NH was allowed to use a bathroom that matched his gender identity, his preferred gender identity. It was simply not the general boys' locker room, that's my understanding from the complaint, but rather a different boys' locker room or a separate area. You know, it's obviously can be described in various ways. But is there any other case that that's like this? And if not, how do we analyze that feature of the case?
Your Honor, in Minnesota, it does not seem like there's any precedent that's quite like this case under the educational institution discrimination statute. And the department just asked the court to apply the plain language that a school district cannot discriminate in any manner, and that includes segregating, in a student's full utilization of and benefit from a school. So just simply applying the plain statutory language that the school district cannot segregate a student. Even if they allowed him to use the boys' locker room, it was a segregated one that he did not want to use. And the school district cannot discriminate in that manner without violating the Minnesota Human Rights Act. And so I think there are other cases interpreting Title IX, as Your Honor has recognized, but I'm not aware of precedent under this educational institution provision that raises similar issues.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Basis, as we said earlier, you have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal. I think your mic is muted.
Oh, thank you so much.
That's good. Now we can hear you.
Given that I know other parties are waiting, I'll try to be quicker than 5 minutes, but I'll just tick off a few points. First of all, Turner tells us, and I quote, that the protection of societal norms is a legitimate legislative goal. And again, it found that making distinctions based on biology was permissible. Goins found the same. We think that's really compelling here. I also appreciate Judge Johnson.
Basis?
Yeah.
On that point, is Goins even good law after Bostick?
Bostick specifically set aside the issue of access to restrooms and locker rooms. All that did is construe Title VII as to whether sex included sexual orientation, including transgender status, and concluded that it did. But Bostock specifically said, the opponents to that interpretation, you know, have a parade of horribles about this is going to mean that locker rooms and restrooms are going to be able to be accessed by transgender people consistent with their identity. So what it said was, not purport to address bathrooms, locker rooms, or anything else of the kind. The only question before us is whether an employer who fires someone simply for being homosexual or transgender has discharged or otherwise discriminated against that individual because of the individual's sex. So it specifically didn't address what's at issue here and decided that it didn't naturally lead, obviously, to that result. I appreciate Judge Johnson's recognition of, you know, the rock and a hard place that school districts are in. I'll give an example. I mean, in 2016, 2017, when this district made the decision that it did, you can see the slew of cases that were pending prior to this time, prior to February, I believe, 2017. And the cases were going both directions. There were the privacy rights advocates attacking policies that allow transgender students access to restrooms consistent with their gender identity. And then there were, of course, plaintiffs like NH that sought to access. Holdings were inconsistent. There were obviously advocates on both sides of the issue appearing before the school board. And of course, the district was aware of Goins and felt that was controlling. And I understand the court may take a different view, but it really viewed the solution that it implemented to allow NH access to the boys' locker room, but one with privacy features lacking in the main boys' locker room, as the best way to thread that impossible needle and to protect all students' interests and privacy rights. There's currently a case pending that was filed in November of 2019, a case by students and parents objecting to the transgender access policy, where transgender students get to pick their locker room and shower locations. And the complaint alleges that a female student who had been sexually assaulted in her past was exposed to the penis of a transgender female student in the locker room. And that court, on a motion to dismiss, allow the Title IX sexual harassment claims to survive the motion to dismiss. That's a pretty darn new case, Students and Parents for Privacy versus School Directors directors, I'm sorry, of Township High School, 377 EPSUP 3rd, 891.
Which jurisdiction is that?
Northern District of Illinois, 2019. So, you know, under the law of other jurisdictions, and still it's possible, regardless of what this court says, that there could be sexual harassment claims filed. So the district was and remains in a difficult position. And, you know, this is why we jointly moved to certify these questions. I think this district and other districts around the state are seeking guidance. But I just want to make really clear that the district's decision to assign NH to the privacy-enhanced locker room was not based on his transgender status, but on, again, on his biological gender for some of the reasons we talked about. I also wanted to confirm there is no case regarding transgender rights that applies strict scrutiny. We addressed Crowder and Piper. They applied intermediate scrutiny. If you look at those cases closely. And with that, I'm out of time. I thank you.
It appears there are no further questions. So that will conclude our argument today. The case is deemed submitted. Thank you to all.